This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, use this number, 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with all our brilliant listener calls, some interesting topics
we're going to talk about. Pill splitting, a common practice to save money, common practice in nursing homes. Does it really work? In other words, is there a danger because we do not split those pills in half? Interesting study.
Who among us has not had the time to split pills in one way?
That's right.
Or yeah.
And what does it mean? And what does it mean for different medications?
Yeah.
Then we're going to talk about the FDA action on acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, and its use in painkillers, and what that bodes for essentially the use of Tylenol in cold remedies in the future.
Yeah. And so, our recipe.
Oh, our recipe is great. It's Moose's pumpkin porky pasta.
A couple of words in here that we're going to have to explain. First of all, Moose, and second of all, Porky?
Porky, that's exactly
right.
It.
800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. Let's go to the phone, Zorba, and welcome a listener in Woodcliff Lake, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm fine, actually, but I was just home for Christmas, and my dad, who's 83, who's had, you know, a little memory problem, as you expect at that age, this year it was frightening, actually. We talked about it. He's perfectly aware that he's losing his memory, which supposedly means that's not Alzheimer's. But he's blaming it on Cymbalta, which the doctor gave him for an antidepressant. He's, you know, had that a little bit his whole life. And then when I said, well, stop taking the drug, and he said the doctor is very reticent, or there's so many dangers with stopping this kind of drug, and, you know, I'm not sure what that answer was, but anyway, his doctor is reluctant to take him off it. So, and I've been on Lexapro, which I really love. Depression seems to run in our family, if you want to talk about that. Mm. But I assume the drug can actually cause this. What are the issues with getting off it, and what are the issues with switching?
Mm-hmm. How long has this memory problem been going on for him?
Well, my mom says it's been, you know, this past year, he says, my dad says, I know what the word is, I just can't think of it. And I said, well, it sounds sort of like a stroke. And I know that his father had little strokelets before he died, you know, little tiny ones. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, that's not it. Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming he was checked for it.
Well, I would definitely go off of it. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I would say, you know, I would want to know if the antidepressant was causing a memory loss. Now,
right,
it's possible they'll all do it, Lexapro being one of the antidepressants. That could do it also. But you want to know whether or not it's a drug-related memory loss. So what you want to do is look at all of the non-essential drugs. You could argue that the antidepressant is essential. But if he's willing to go off, and if your mother's willing to have him off, because
right,
obviously he had depression, I think I'd go off of it. You taper off of it. Often the way to do it is either to go to half the dose for a week or to a dose every other day for a week and then quit. I'd call up the doctor and say I'd do it. And you could also get permission from your dad to talk to the doctor.
Right.
Have you talked to the doctor?
I have not.
Uh-huh. Would he give you permission, or would he think you're taking away power from him?
No, I don't think he'd think that.
Yeah, I think
I would ask him.
Yeah, I think I would talk to the doctor, because first of all, the doctor may not want to take him, you know, may feel that he shouldn't be off, but there may be something else going on. And I think if you could talk to the doctor directly, you will get more information. And obviously, you're caring for your aging parents. You should be the one to talk. So,
right.
I think that's really good.
Right. Is it really just a week of half dose and then you can stop?
Yeah. I mean, there are people that stop all the time. They'll say, I don't want to take this drug anymore, and they go cold turkey. And antidepressants, you know, we don't recommend them. We recommend tapering off. But I've never really looked at a study that compared tapering off antidepressants with stopping them suddenly. I don't know if there's a study out there. We just do it because we think that's good medical care, but it may not even be scientifically based. I know that'll shock you, but a lot of things in medicine are not scientifically based. Tom is shocked by this. In fact, he can he's covering his eyes because he can't believe it. So it may just be habit that we've done for years, and it may not be, have anything. But there are people who stop it because they go, well, my drug plan changed, and I'm not taking it anymore. That happens every day in my office. In fact, many, many drugs are stopped suddenly for a whole bunch of reasons, like, oh, I left it at home and I didn't take it. So, but getting back to the issue at hand, I, being a doctor of pattern, would recommend that he taper off of it. But I think you ought to call his doc first.
Okay.
I think that's a critical issue. There may be something else going on. And you want to find out. Now, you said they must have checked him for strokes. The answer is maybe yes, maybe no.
Right.
CT scans don't necessarily show it. MRI scans are much more expensive, and they would often show more than the CT scan is. But I think the bang for your buck is this drug-related?
Right.
Good luck, and thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
800-462-7413. Can I uncover my eyes now?
Yes, you can uncover your eyes. That's right. Glad you weren't driving.
Yeah. As we go to our first topic of the day, pill splitting.
Right. Pill splitting. Interesting study. What they did is they had volunteers, mm-hmm. and they had professional nurses, mm-hmm. Basically break pills in half.
Yep.
Some of the pills would be split with their fingers, some would be split with a knife, and some would be split with a pill splitter. They make these things called pill splitters.
Yep.
They have a little razor blade in them, and they wanted to find out how people did. And lo and behold, it found out that that the pills were not equal. In other words, you break a pill in half, and they weren't equal. They were often different. By 15% or 20%. Yeah. Somewhere as different as 25%. So one half might be 75%, might half be 25%.
Yeah. But now, some pills, I would guess it wouldn't make that much difference.
Well, this is where it's really at. Some pills, it makes no difference at all. Cholesterol pills. Good example, Lipitor, very expensive pill. Mm-hmm. If you're on it, you're going to be on 40 milligrams a day or 20. Why not split an 80 milligram pill or a 40 milligram pill? Mm-hmm. And basically, so maybe you're going to get 25 milligrams one day and you'll get, 35 milligrams the next day or something like that.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter with a drug like Lipitor. But it may matter with a blood pressure pill.
Okay.
Because a blood pressure pill, it may make a difference. It may be one day, you're getting 3/4 of the pill, and one day you're getting 1/4 of the pill, and you go into the doctor the day after you took the 1/4 of the mm-hmm. pill, and your pressure is high, and all of a sudden you're going to have a higher, you're going to get more medication that you may not need. So for a blood pressure pill, may make a difference. For a thyroid pill, probably doesn't make a difference. For a seizure medication, it probably does make a difference. So I think this particular study, there's been a movement toward pill splitting, which I think is an excellent idea.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you save money. But I think we should develop a list of drugs that can be split and then a list of drugs that should not be split.
Yeah.
And until that list is really developed, what we really have to do is make sure you talk to your doctor, your pharmacist. Now, some people argue, well, the pharmaceutical companies should just make them in smaller doses. That's true, but if it's to save money, they're going to charge just as much money for the smaller pills.
Yeah,
so that doesn't
yeah,
really answer the question very well.
Okay. Important topic.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
800-462-7413. It's toll free. And Zorba, a Chicago, Illinois listener, is with us now. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
I have a question really about the treatment of uterine fibroids. Oftentimes, a lot of gynecologists will recommend hysterectomies, and I really wanted to talk about alternative treatments. I actually have had a uterine fibroid embolization, and it hasn't completely resolved the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my concern and what I wanted to talk to you about was, why is it that physicians are so eager to, suggest a hysterectomy and not talk about the side effects and the consequences of hysterectomies? Because surgery, to me, seems an extreme, route when there's consequences to surgery.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, the embolization, because not a lot of our listeners know what that is, are essentially you go in and a physician, often a radiologist, will go in, or another trained procedurist, as we call them, will go and essentially embolize the artery that's feeding the fibroid, which is this bump in the uterus. It's a benign tumor, and then it shrinks. And so if you've got one big one or two or three, it can often be effective shrink, so you don't need to have a hysterectomy because basically that fibroid is no longer there. And it becomes smaller and smaller. If you have multiple ones or too many of them, that's not going to work, and you can't often tell until you're actually in there and find out how they're actually fed, where the arteries are from. So you had that procedure that failed.
I've had it twice.
You've had it twice. So it failed, so you tried that. It's
partially successful because they were able to reach several of the fibroids, mm-hmm. but then when I say partially, because other ones grew over the last couple of years in between the first and second.
Okay, so that's one issue of doing it. Another procedure that is often done, and there's certain criteria that have to be met, is basically a scraping out. Now, I'm not talking about a D&C, which is a scraping out just of the lining, but they go in and they remove the lining of the uterus. And for some people, that's very helpful. And usually, these are women who have excessive bleeding. They may have some fibroids, but it's usually an excessive bleeding issue. It often is related to fibroids, but it doesn't make the fibroids smaller in many cases. It just gets rid of the lining, so you're not bleeding as much. Looking now at the surgical part, I understand the fear of the keloid issue. And keloids, you know, I may put you at risk for internal adhesions, but really keloids are a skin issue. Now, on the other hand, the surgery, hysterectomy, is the most common, or if not, and one of the most common surgeries for sure, that's basically recommended in the U.S. and done. And there are a lot of women who don't need it. And there are a lot of women who have side effects from the hysterectomy. And it behooves every physician to hand a woman all of the information that she needs to be able to make an informed decision. That is absolutely right on point. That score. And the fact is, a lot of physicians don't spend the time doing it because they want to spend the time in the operating room. That's the reality. Sometimes they're not that interested. So what you want to do is go to an OBGYN who will take the time, give you the information so that you can make a rational decision on what's right for you. So you're right on with that. And I applaud you for bringing that up because I think that's a very important issue.
Well, I appreciate that, and I thank you for your insight. I also hope that, you know, too, that women will ask and, you know, not rush just for surgery. But, again, my concern, because it's not resolved, is, you know, to explore other alternatives.
Well, I think you're right on. That is absolutely the issue. And as I said, there's several.
Until menopause kicks in.
There are these other alternatives, and that's why you have to go find an OBGYN that will go over those with you. And good luck. It's not easy.
Thank you.
It's not easy.
Thank you. We appreciate the call at 1-800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Springfield, Missouri. Hi. What's up?
Okay, so here is my question. I am really genetically prone to cystic acne, as in it's everybody on my father's side, except for one sister, has always had this as a problem. I am 30 years old now, and I've really suffered from cystic acne since I was probably 13. And over the last couple of years, what I have found is I kind of tried this randomly, but what I found is that if I use oil, like coconut oil or castor oil or really just straight up oil, and I kind of massage it into my skin, that it removes those black, it literally takes, like, grit comes out of my skin. And then I wash it off. I've done this for about a year and a half, and I have not had any cystic acne since. And, I mean, I had that on my face always for at least in one point in my face.
Mm-hmm. So, well, you know, one of the things that's on your side is often as you get older, often acne gets better. I mean, it doesn't always get better. Some people have acne for life. So that's one issue. Accutane, very, very good drug, has significant side effects, has to be used the right way. In fact, you actually have to be certified to be able to use Accutane. In other words, if you don't go through some special continuing medical education and ongoing education, you can't actually prescribe it because of the side effects. And for people who have serious cystic acne, it's a dynamite drug that can change their lives. And for other people with cystic acne, regular antibiotics that you take on a regular basis, doxycycline, minocycline, erythromycin, can make a big difference with acne that can be very useful. You have found a topical remedy that works for you Keep it up. I can't tell because it's not a study. It may be that you're just getting better and the topical remedy has nothing to do with it because your acne went away. Doesn't sound like that to me. It sounds like this topical remedy may be working for you, and I'd keep it up certainly for a while to make sure that acne is cleared up. So it's wonderful that you shared that with us. Appreciate it.
Do you think it is healthy or, I think it's so strange, and it's against whatever I've been taught, but it works for me. I'm not going to stop. Does it make sense to you that it was?
It doesn't make sense to me in the least. Not in the least. But you know what? There are a lot of things in life that don't make sense to me that end up working. And certainly in medicine, there are things sometimes that are counterintuitive. And then we find out 10 years later, they're really not counterintuitive. And I'll give you the perfect example. In medical school, I was taught never, ever give aspirin to people having a heart attack. They'll bleed out. We give aspirin all the time now. Yeah. I still remember the head of medicine saying, never give an aspirin. I mean, he called me out. I had done a little research, and I said, looks like aspirin might be good. And he called me out as a student, embarrassed me in front of the class. Morton Bogdanoff, not a very nice person.
Oh.
He was head of internal medicine at the University of Illinois. He was kind of a nasty person personally. I'm serious. He was not a very nice person. Called me out and said, Mr. Pastor, how could you, not even doctor, of course I was a student, how could you recommend that aspirin? Aspirin is a terrible drug, and here it is. We use it today. Now, Mort was old, so he's dead now. It won't make any difference. But anyway, I mention that because there are things in medicine that are counterintuitive. Maybe this is a treatment, and good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Now, can the family of a deceased sue someone?
You mean for character defamation? Character defamation.
Before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and see if we can help out a longtime listener. We have a note here from Catherine, who says she's been listening to our show since she was 6 years old.
Wow.
She writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I have a question concerning hair loss. I am a young, very active woman, 22 years old, with long hair. Over the past several months, I've noticed that I have been losing what I consider to be alarming amounts of hair. A friend mentioned that this hair loss could be due to my high activity level. I typically run between 50 and 70 miles per week. I'm curious as to whether or not you could shed some light on my problem, though, in the event that my hair loss increases in the future. So, Zorba, is she outrunning her hair?
Oh, gosh, that is really something. There are a lot of reasons for hair loss. It's there's never a simple answer. You can get hair loss because of psychological stress. You can get hair loss because of physiological stress. High fever, you could have a fever for 2 or 3 days, 103, 104 fever, and you'll get a hair loss that'll last for 6 months and get better. You can also get hair loss if you are not eating correctly, and it's a big issue with women athletes who often run excessively and then don't eat properly, and that can be an issue, and especially in women athletes who stop menstruating. When they stop menstruating, and it often is due to the fact that they are exercising sort of, I don't want to say more than their body can take, but in a very athletic way so that the estrogen simply doesn't affect the uterus in the way it normally does. And often that's associated with not eating a well-rounded diet. So I think before I would stop exercising, what I would do is I would look at my diet, make sure that I have lots of fruits and vegetables and I'm eating right. I think I'd also go to a doctor, have them look at a dermatologist or your family doctor. I'd have your hair looked at, see if there's another reason before I would slow down running, because sounds like she loves running, sounds like she's an athlete, and I think I'd keep that up and make a diagnosis. Yeah.
Interesting. Brush away your lifestyle problems by sending them to the show. Send your email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up next. More of your calls, of course, our medical myth buster as well, and another topic to talk over here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number again is 800-462-7413. We have callers waiting, but a line open for you at 800-462-7413. But before we take our next listener call, it is recipe time. And for our recipe this week, I am thrilled to welcome St. Louis, Missouri listener Moose Dixon. Moose, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. It's good to have you with us here for the recipe. Now, I'm thinking, Moose, either your parents have a really good sense of humor, mm-hmm. or your dad was hunting just before you were born, or maybe you were a big, really ugly-looking baby. Am I right on either of those?
Well, I would hope you're wrong on pretty much most of them.
Well, tell us about Moose, then.
Well, it's actually a nickname. The derivation goes Tom, Thomas, Tomus, Moose.
So you started out a Tom.
Yeah, Tom is a good name.
And ended up a Moose.
Well,
Moose is a kind of a fun name.
I'm going to call you Moose. I'm going to call you Moose, and I'm going to call Tom opposite me Moose from now on.
This is Moose's pasta with pumpkin. This is really an interesting thing. How did you come up with this one?
I actually found it while scouring the internet. I think I found it at Green Bites originally, but mm-hmm. We've always loved pumpkin here, and we just went for it.
Okay, so you adopted this from an internet recipe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's a Porky? I mean, I hate to say it, but Porky is not a common word that I tend to use.
Well, no, actually, it was invented by Kiwi Carlisle, one of the preeminent cooks in the greater St. Louis area.
Oh,
mm-hmm. It's one part pork sausage to three parts turkey.
Ooh. So, okay, so we're going to make the recipe, and yep. I'm going to ask you things. Start out with 8 ounces of whole wheat fusilli pasta. Now, how did you choose your type of pasta?
I've always enjoyed whole wheat pasta, so I just grabbed the first thing out of the pantry, and it happened to be the twirly pasta.
Uh-huh. That's great. And generally, I choose whatever. I have a variety of pasta in my pantry. Tom happens to be just a spaghetti and meatballs
person.
You got it.
Yeah, you remember.
That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at pasta in his pantry, if we can find it, then it's generally spaghetti. Not even elbow macaroni, right, Tom?
No, right.
Not even elbow macaroni.
Only spaghetti.
Not a ribbon. You don't have a ribbon
not
on
even
there.
Thin spaghetti.
Not regular
spaghetti.
Just regular spaghetti. It's
Tom.
Like that's
Tom
his middle
word. Adventurous.
Yes, it's not when it comes to pasta, he's not adventurous. A pound of Porky, and like you said, a Porky is one part ground pork, so pork sausage. Is it ground pork or is it pork sausage?
We buy it ground.
In background. Yeah, and when I use a ground pork, which I use in a tofu recipe, which is Mapo tofu, I usually have it ground twice. Do you do it when you buy that in the grocery store, or you just have it ground once?
It's ground when we get it out of the store, and then we mix it by hand. We don't put it through a grinder of
okay,
any sort.
Okay, so then you mix it by hand.
Yeah.
Okay, so a pound of porky, one small onion chopped,
mm-hmm.
3 cloves of garlic. Do you like garlic?
Oh, yeah. There is no such thing as too much garlic in this house.
That's something I can believe in. Sometimes I'll take my pre-chopped garlic and I'll just throw in a nice handful, and that's what I use.
Mm-hmm.
A 15-ounce can of chicken broth. Use the low-sodium or regular chicken broth?
Low-sodium. And we actually get ours in refrigerator containers, but we still use the 15-ounce.
Yeah, I think that's good. There was an article that I saw on Cook's Illustrated fairly recently that did a taste test on the low-sodium chicken broth versus the regular, and they found the low-sodium had a far better flavor because it had less salt, and so it had to be more flavorful or people were not going to buy it. So I'm stuck on low-sodium. Half a package of frozen spinach.
Right.
So what do you do with the other half?
Save it for the next time we use the recipe, actually.
Ah, that's what I like to see. A frugal gourmet. Remember the frugal mm-hmm. gourmet, Tom?
Sure.
Yeah, frugal gourmet.
I've heard of it.
15-ounce. That's right. That's as far as it goes. He remembers it. 15-ounce can of pumpkin.
Pumpkin. Mm-hmm.
Very important for people to buy the pumpkin that doesn't say pumpkin pie pumpkin on there because that will have
right.
sweetness in it. I mean, it's pure
right.
pumpkin. Read that label. Yeah. It's got to just say pumpkin.
Yeah.
A 1/4 cup of non-fat Greek yogurt.
Right.
So non-fat Greek yogurt.
What's Greek yogurt?
Well, it tastes differently. It has sort of a sour taste. Well, not sour. It has more of a... Is it sour the right word?
It does remind me of sour cream, though.
No. It's more... It has a different texture. It has a different taste. You can buy them in good grocery stores. The texture is different. The taste is different. Regular yogurt, I'm sure, would work, but the Greek yogurt has more of a robust taste. It'll be explained. A teaspoon of sage.
Uh-huh.
1 teaspoon of sage. 1/4 teaspoon of fresh nutmeg. So you buy nutmeg in the little nutmeg berries?
Actually, we prefer grinding as much as we can. Mm-hmm. And on that night, I ground a nutmeg for the first time in my life.
Uh-huh. How'd you do it? In a spice grinder? Is that what you did?
No, my wife has a little, essentially a plane that we just ground it up over.
Yeah, you grind it over a plane. The nut of nutmeg is remarkably soft. And all of a sudden, the whole room smells like nutmeg.
My wife is telling me that it's a nutmeg grinder.
It's a nutmeg grinder.
A nutmeg grater.
So now I know what to get Tom for Christmas next year. A nutmeg grater. So that's
I'll say, what's this for?
That's exactly what you'll say. 1/4 teaspoon of fresh ground black pepper.
Mm-hmm.
And Parmesan for dusting. So let's make the recipe. Cook the pasta according to the package instructions. Very important. Read those instructions of how many minutes you check the pasta and do it on a timer. It really does make a difference, especially if you want to get it al dente. I hope I pronounced it right.
I think I did.
But the L might be wrong. It might be al dente. I'll never get it right. And every Italian in the world writes in an email and says you've got it wrong. But we'll try it as al dente, and I bet people will let me know. Meanwhile, heat a large skillet over medium.
Throw in here that go heavy on the large. I was truly amazed at just how much volume this dish puts out. I actually had trouble stirring it at the end.
Really, really. So, yeah. So did you have to stand on a chair to stir it because it was so much?
I very nearly decided to put it into a large kettle because the skillet wasn't large enough.
Oh, really? So we've got to use a large skillet I've got a cast iron skillet at home, which is a
good
big one. Heat up very large skillet. We won't say large. A very large skillet, extra large skillet, over medium high heat. Spray it with nonstick spray and brown the porky mixture with onions and garlic. Do you do the onions and garlic first, or you throw everything in all at one time?
I tend to do all the non-meat stuff just a couple of minutes first and then throw in the meat.
I think that's good because that'll really saute the garlic and the onion together, then throw in the meat stuff, the porky. Once browned, add the chicken broth and frozen spinach. Bring it to a boil. Lower to medium heat. Then add the pumpkin, yogurt, sage, nutmeg, and ground pepper. Stir. Oh, I love this. Wait till the sauce boils again and then reduce it to a simmer. Then add the cooked pasta to the skillet. So you add it all together and stir to combine everything. Serve with a dusting of Parmesan cheese and enjoy. I've not tried this. I think I'm going to go home tonight and try it.
Sounds good.
Oh, it's great.
What do you serve with this, Moose?
Actually, I don't think we served anything with it. It was pretty much a one-dish meal.
Yeah. You know what comes to my mind? Can of cranberry sauce. I would think cranberry would go with this.
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, I think this would be good. This is great. I love this recipe. I think it's absolutely fantastic, and I am going to try it. I am going to try it tonight. It is wonderful. It is wonderful.
The first time I tried it, my neighbor said she got hungry just coming up the stairwell smelling it.
That means it's a good recipe. It's a good recipe.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, no problem.
Thanks a lot, Moose, for sending us this winning recipe. Moose gets a free copy of our cookbook, Heart Healthy, Low Fat, Guilt Free, and Tasty Recipes from the Kitchen of Zorba Pastor. And if you want to enter our recipe contest, it's easy. Just email your original low fat recipe to us at
Zorba@WPR.org.
And if you want a copy of today's recipe, visit our website at
ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for a weekly recipe podcast and search all of your favorite Zorba Pastor on Your Health recipes. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. To the phones now, Zorba, and a listener in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
We have a very interesting living arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
Today we're in St. Augustine. By the end of the week, we will be someplace else. because we are full-time sailboat liveaboards.
Wow. Are you on the boat right now?
We are on the boat right now. We are floating around right outside of the city of St. Augustine in a mooring field. So it's a fabulous lifestyle, and each day is a new day, that's for sure.
Do you spend the whole year on the boat?
We spend the whole year on the boat.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Boy, I'm jealous. That sounds like a really wonderful lifestyle.
It is a wonderful lifestyle, and it's all about the people that we have met, and but we have certainly had the opportunity to really see a different part of the world because you get to see it from the water.
Yeah. Well, that sounds pretty neat, but you didn't just call to rub it into us. You must have a question for Zorba.
I do have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Because of being either in the water or very, you know, on the coast, we have all sorts of opportunity to have fish. Now, if we're lucky enough to catch our own fish, that is a blessing, and I know exactly how fresh that fish is.
Mm-hmm.
However, going to various local seafood markets, you sort of never know. And I am a nurse and a very good cook, and those two combinations sometimes make me wonder about things. And although I certainly can trust a sushi-grade fish for anything I want to prepare, I have wondered what happens when you actually use a lime juice or lemon juice to what they say cook the fish. And that's, for instance, a ceviche, where you're going to take the fish and sort of brine it in a lime juice, and you do that for anywhere from, you know, 6 to 8 to 12 hours. But is that really healthy? In other words, I know that it changes the texture to make the mouth feel like it's cooked, but are you really taking care of any bacteria or other things like fish tapeworms or any of those sorts of things so that you are not introducing something that could be dangerous?
Well, sure. First of all, if you're taking ceviche, which a number of our listeners may not know what it is, it's really a raw fish product. It may be brined, but it's really raw fish. And that actually doesn't kill anything. I mean, it's not the same as pickling. When you pickle, when you pickle a cucumber or something, either you pickle it and you put it in the refrigerator and you have something cold, or you pickle it and you essentially heat it up so that it's been heated to a certain temperature to kill the bacteria. So you have to make sure that you use a fish which is the same as sushi. Now, sushi, when you're eating sushi, there's no guarantee, because it is a raw fish product, that you're going to be healthy because it hasn't been cooked. And the same with oysters. When you eat oysters, unless it's oyster stew, there's no guarantee that you're not going to get sick from it. And we have a lot of foodborne poisoning in America, but believe it or not, most of it doesn't come from that. Most of it ends up coming from undercooked hamburger and E. coli and from feedlots, so where there really is a lot of E. coli around, or from salmonella and chicken. So getting the ceviche issue, if you catch the fish and you make ceviche from your fish, you know when the fish was caught. You know it's going to be as safe as it possibly can be, and the risk is very minimal. If you buy it somewhere else from the store, you don't know how long it's actually been there. And they may tell you it's been there for a day, and maybe they're right, and maybe they're not right. Maybe it's been there for a day, and it was also there for a day yesterday. So you don't know exactly what that is. So I think being careful with a raw fish product makes a lot of sense from a health point of view. Once you cook it, it's okay. You know, as long as you cook fish in a normal fashion, you're going to basically destroy the bacteria that are there and the worms that are there.
Right.
Now, I've got a question. How long have you been doing this?
We have been living aboard our boat for 13 years, and we have been completely on board without a house or a car or anything for 14 months.
That sounds
really
wonderful.
Neat.
Congratulations. Enjoy. Enjoy it. Enjoy
and
it.
And your recipe sounds delicious. I'm off to buy all that stuff today.
Great. Absolutely great.
And I have a solution to your fish question. You've got
yes.
a frying pan on board that boat, don't you?
Absolutely.
There you go. Throw the fish in the frying pan. You're off.
I will take you up on that.
Okay.
Off the hook.
That was really an unintended
pun. I love it. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, right.
800-462-7413. It's toll-free, 1-800-462-7413. Before the break, Zorba, let's take a quick question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This question comes to us from Kathy in Rochester, New York. Kathy writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba and Tom, I spent 4 years in Madison, Wisconsin, and now live in Buffalo, New York, both places with long, cold winters. I like to heat my milk in the microwave and sprinkle it with cinnamon and nutmeg as a comforting start to the day. Does heating milk, either in the microwave or on the stove, destroy any of the nutrients, specifically the calcium? I don't want to stop, but I don't want to think I'm getting a serving of calcium when I'm not."
Well, it doesn't destroy the calcium. Calcium is inorganic, and it doesn't get destroyed. When you heat milk, you probably destroy some of the vitamins that are present in there, but you're not going to destroy the protein. If you heat it too hot, of course, then the protein congeals on the top, and you burn the pan. Yeah. It congeals on the bottom. Yeah. That's different. But just heating it up is not really going to change the protein much. In fact, it may make the protein even more bioavailable. But for sure, you don't destroy the calcium. I think that sounds kind of comforting.
Yeah,
I like
it does,
that. Doesn't it?
Yeah.
Sound like that? What does she put on? Cinnamon and what else?
Yeah.
Little cinnamon. I've never had cinnamon on the top of it.
I never
have.
Have
you?
Either.
I like that. I like that as a concept in the winter. You get up and you have a little warm milk.
Yep.
And then you sort of get your things going and you look outside and you say, I just love winter. Yeah. And you walk outside the door and you're happy. Yeah. Milk makes you happy.
Very relaxed.
Very relaxed. In fact, thinking about it, I can hardly do the rest of the show.
I was just saying, do we have to do the rest of it?
I'm ready to drink my milk.
Anyway, let us find out if your lifestyle question stands up to the heat. Just send your comments, questions, and tips in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org and send in those cookies for our milk, folks.
But we are going to move along here. We have a really interesting topic to talk over. Lots more of your calls and, of course, our medical myth buster later on here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our number again, 800-462-7413. But before we take our next call, Zorba, new rules from the FDA on acetaminophen?
There are some issues. You know, Tylenol for many years was thought of as pristine. You could take as much as you want to. It was not an issue. It was a benign drug. It was given to children, of course, for fever, far better than aspirin. We don't give aspirin to reduce fever in children anymore at all. And lo and behold, about one or two decades ago, we discovered that people who were drinking significant amounts of alcohol and Tylenol were going into liver failure. Mm-hmm. And so we started limiting the amount of Tylenol you would have, basically 2,000 milligrams a day if you drink an alcoholic beverage or two a day max, 4,000 milligrams a day if you're hardly drinking anything at all, and 2,000 if you're a drinker. Mm-hmm. Well, the FDA has now looked at Tylenol, which is pretty much in a lot of things, cold remedies and over-the-counter painkillers, but they've looked at the prescription painkillers, Percocet and Vicodin, and some of them come with more than 325 milligrams of Tylenol, which is the standard Tylenol amount of acetaminophen.
Yeah. Is that what you see full strength on the...
Well, full strength, extra strength is 500 milligrams.
Okay.
That's what it is. Regular strength is 325 milligrams. So a lot of drug companies about 15, 20 years ago, as a marketing tool, said, we're going to give you more Tylenol. So Vicodin dose, instead of being 5 of hydrocodone and 325 of Tylenol, was 5 of hydrocodone and either 500 of Tylenol or 650 milligrams of Tylenol in a higher dose. And the feds have said, no more. We want to start to get Tylenol and acetaminophen out of prescription painkillers. And to me, this is the first step. What they're going to do is start to limit Tylenol as an ingredient, I think, and a lot of other things, including cold remedies. I think this is the first step. And the reason is they estimate that over 50,000 people go to the emergency room annually for acetaminophen or Tylenol overdoses. And they think about 100 to 200 of those are actually dying from this, which makes it a big public health problem.
Oh, yeah, of course. But I mean, it does kill pain, and if you reduce the amount, then the pain isn't going to be.
Well, that's a good issue. The good issue is, do you really need two 500-milligram tablets, or can you get by with two 325-milligram tablets? And the studies don't show there's that much of a difference. It's that it was really a marketing tool. We'll call it extra strength, and it caught on that people want extra-strength Tylenol versus regular-strength Tylenol. So I think what we want to do is look at our guidelines. The guidelines are this. If you don't drink, you can take 4,000 milligrams of acetaminophen. If you drink on a regular basis, especially more than a drink a day, you can only go to 2,000 milligrams. Read those labels and reduce the amount of Tylenol that you are getting in painkillers, over-the-counter remedies, or headache remedies.
800-462-7413, the number to call if you have a question for Zorba. And our next listener on the line is in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Fine, how can we help?
Well, I've had a problem as I've gotten older. My toenails have turned thicker and harder and more irregular and kind of off-colored, kind of a yellow. And I've tried different remedies. The last thing I tried was tincture of iodine and clear. And I've been doing that for almost a year now, and I haven't had any luck with that. And I was hoping that Dr. Zorba would have some words of wisdom for me to try.
He probably will, but let me jump in. Why is this a problem? The way you describe it, they're thicker and different color. Who cares? Well, how is this troubling you?
Well, like when I wear sandals and things, they just look, they're not, appearance-wise is all that it is.
So it's
it
a
really
cosmetic issue. You can cut them all right and everything.
Yes, yes, I can cut them. They're thicker, but you can cut them.
Yeah, a couple of questions. When you cut them, do they kind of, are they friable? Do they kind of dust apart when you're cutting them, you know?
No, they don't. I've tried, you know, sanding them down or, you know, using
sanding
an emery board to
down.
Sand them
uh-huh.
down to even uh-huh. them up a little in that uh-huh. and to make them thinner.
Uh-huh.
But then they become more friable, I
yeah,
guess.
No, that's what they do. They become yeah. dusty. Well, the first question is whether or not you've got a fungal infection of the toenails. That's not an uncommon thing. That is a very common thing. And the way you can find that out is by going to your doctor. They do a scraping of the nail. They look at it under the microscope, stain it with something called KOH, and see whether or not there are fungal elements there. And sometimes that's very, very useful to actually go forth and do. So that's one way to do it. If that's the case, the drug Lamisil, Lamisil, 250 milligram tablets can do the trick. The drug used to be outrageously expensive. It's off patent. It's become significantly cheaper. For some plans, it's a generic, so it doesn't cost much of anything. But what you do with the Lamisil is you take it 1 week out of four, for about 6 months. So in other words, you take it like the first week of the month, every single month for 6 months. And often that'll do the trick. So a lot of these are fungal infections. Now, if they're not a fungal infection, if they're just kind of senior nails, I guess would be the phrase that I would say it, then what you do is then you have to do it in an architectural way. Some people go to a podiatrist. Some buy a Dremel. You know, the Dremels that are used, guys always know what Dremels are. Girls do not, on the whole. That's what I've discovered. Now, there's some women who know what it is, but somehow every single man says...
I don't know what a Dremel is.
Well, every single guy who's ever built things. Do you ever build things? Like, a hobbyist? Are you a hobbyist?
No,
not at all.
Kind of like a rototooler.
It's a rototooler. Okay. That's a little... makes a little sound.
Yeah. I get it.
And but you have to be careful, because if you go over the skin, you'll hurt it. Yep. And some people Dremel their nails. And they do it once every 3 months, and they basically push it down that way. I'd look at the fungal thing because it sounds fungal to me.
Well, I have a non-drug answer to your question.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm all ears.
Yeah, I'm all ears too, Tom. Please, please. We're both
it's easy. Yeah. Nail polish.
Oh, nail polish.
Pink, purple.
I've thought about that.
There you go.
I figure I don't know if that's acceptable for a man to have nail polish.
It would set you apart.
It would set you apart. And besides, we're in a new age where men can dress in a peacock fashion just like women.
Good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call at 800-462-7413.
So what color would you choose, Tom?
I think I'd go purple.
See, you'd go purple. Now, I would go white. I'd go white, kind of ivory with sparkles.
We have a common male friend who puts nail polish on the pinky on one of his
hands. Exactly. He's done that for a while. It's very strange looking. I can tell you that.
Well, time now, Zorba, once again for our medical myth buster. Today's myth deals with an issue that's very common here in our own home state of Wisconsin: beer bellies. While it's a well-used phrase, is it true that too much beer will cause a bigger belly?
Only because you may be having too many calories. That's about it. There is no such thing as a beer belly. It's that people who drink a lot of beer often become fat because they are drinking so much beer. And if we look at beer, I mean, a bottle of beer, the calories vary all over the place. You can get, you know, calories that are low, MD50. No, MD50, I think, is a wine. It's completely different. But you can get a low-calorie beer we'll say is around 95 calories. And some of the beers actually go really high up, depending on how much you have, 300 calories. So people, guys and women too, who drink a lot of beer, they have a beer belly because they're getting overweight. And there was a study a number of years ago in Czechoslovakia, and the Czechs drink more beer than anyone else. And there is absolutely no link. The Czechs who drink a lot of beer and eat a lot of calories have big bellies, and the Czechs who drink a lot of beer and don't eat anything else have small bellies.
So we could call them ice cream bellies,
cheeseburger bellies. I like it. You've got a cheeseburger belly.
If you have a myth that you've been belly aching about and want it busted, send your medical myth to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413, our telephone number, and a listener now in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I am a woman in my late 40s, and I've always had low HDL. And then when I had my ovaries removed a year ago, that number plummeted even more. So my doctor, tried some niacin, and it just seemed that my liver number, function number, was climbing a little bit, and she took me off of the niacin, but it did make me kind of wonder, because I was traveling at the time, I wasn't well hydrated, and I wondered if maybe that lack of hydration could have caused those liver function numbers to climb a little more than they would have, under better conditions.
Oh, sure. Let's talk about niacin and that, and then let's talk about the HDL issue. The answer is yes. Sometimes you'll have stress. You could have a drink. You could have an alcoholic beverage. You could have a virus. You could be dehydrated and your liver functions could go up. So there's no doubt about it. So, and sometimes labs make mistakes. Shocking as it is, lab error does occur. So I think I would definitely get a repeat HDL on the niacin to see whether or not the niacin is causing it. A certain percentage of the time, might be 10%, might be 20%, it doesn't cause it at all, and things are good. I want to get back to the HDL. How low is your HDL? Let's talk about that.
Well, it was usually around 48 before my ovaries were removed, and then it dropped to 38.
So it dropped from 48 to 38. By the way, I don't consider 38 to be terribly low. It's somewhat low, but it's not 25 or 20. That's really low. Are you a smoker? No. Do you drink more than 2 drinks a day on average? I don't mean every so often, but I mean, do you drink a lot of alcohol?
No. I mean, I usually do have a glass of wine in the evening.
No, we're talking about the bottle of wine in the evening. Do you exercise on a regular basis?
Yes.
Okay. So I don't think 38 is that low. The real question is, do you need to be on niacin? Well, what's the proof that niacin reduces heart attack and stroke? The answer is not much. There is proof that high doses of niacin, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 milligrams, increases HDL, but the proof that it actually reduces heart attack and stroke is scant. It's not strong. Now, let's assume you were a guy with a strong family history, with previous bypass surgery or, you know, coronary artery disease that's proven, with an HDL of 20, I think that's a different issue. Mm-hmm. Then I'd say, try the niacin. Let's see if it works because you're at high risk. And to me, that's really, really where you use the niacin. But for somebody who's got an HDL of 38, what's your LDL or bad cholesterol?
Between 83 and 100.
So you've got an LDL that's primo,
yeah,
and you've got an HDL that's not that bad. I think you're over-medicated. I wouldn't take the niacin.
Yay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, you really made my day.
Well, good.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you.
We appreciate the call. Always nice to make somebody's day.
Yeah, I mean, that was very nice. I mean, you know, that was very nice. But I think she was over-medicated. Yeah. I think that's the issue.
Well, we'll end it on that one. And before we punch out for the week, Zorba, we do have a small matter to deal with from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police. Actually, this one might come from their math bureau. It comes to us from Deputy John. He writes, Zorba, I always enjoy your show. However, on a recent show, you had a mathematical error. You were talking about a recipe that had half the calories of a Subway club sandwich and stated something like the club had 50% more calories. Actually, it would be more accurate to state that the club had 100% more calories since it has approximately twice as many.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Exactly right. You know, I mean, the math teachers will get me every single time. Well, they're right.
I'm going to call you 50% right on that one. If you want to help Zorba cut his grammar mistakes down by 50 or even 100%, then join the Zorba Pastor on Your Health Grammar Police. You can do so by sending an email to the show at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web at
ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by the amazing Race Rejected team of Adam Friedrich, executive producer, and Brad Kohlberg, technical director. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, guaranteeing 100% that we'll see you next week on Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0211Z. More on healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, show archives, and listener feedback, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.